from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, New York Times reporter Rukmini Kalamachi has spent the last couple of years digging into the inner workings of ISIS.
I am trying to answer one question. Who are they?
In her new documentary podcast, Caliphate, Kalamachi gives listeners a rare, behind-the-scenes look into the power and appeal of ISIS among its members and what it's like to cover a brutal terrorist group up close. Join our conversation after this news. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. And in this hour, we're joined by New York Times foreign correspondent Rukmini Kalamachi, who has delved into the hidden world of the terrorist group ISIS.
I am looking for ISIS's diary. I am looking for their internal correspondence, their receipts, their personal tiffs with co-workers, some of which end up getting sent to the equivalent of ISIS HR.
That's a recording from her new 10-part podcast called Caliphate, where Kalamachi rummages through the rubble of bombed-out ISIS hideouts and poses probing questions to former members to give listeners a sense of the people who join this brutal regime. She also gives a behind-the-scenes look at the emotional and ethical struggles of covering a group that has brutally murdered and terrorized scores of people in the West and the Middle East. Rukmini Kalamachi, welcome to Forum.
Thank you for having me, Nina.
Well, thank you so much for being here. It's actually Mina with an M.
Mina, excuse me.
No problem.
Sorry, thanks.
What have you found has been the most effective strategy for getting inside information, the information that's so little known about ISIS?
So the most, I think, proven way to do that is to look for the documents that this group left behind. They're not easy to find. The only place that you can find them is in areas that have just recently been liberated from the terrorist group. These areas tend to be on the front lines or near the front lines. And as a result, it's dangerous, you know, to be there. And you can only go there, at least in Iraq, if you're embedded with Iraqi forces. So that's what I did over roughly a one-year period, over five different trips to Iraq. I was with the Iraqi commanders and troops who were taking back these areas. And with their permission, we entered the buildings that had recently been liberated and looked for these records. And unbelievably, this group tends to leave a lot of paperwork behind.
I want to give our listeners a sense of the podcast. And you basically set up well one of the clips that I want to play where you're talking about your producer is interviewing you and asking
yes.
you about the dangers
sure.
of going into these buildings
sure.
that have just been bombed by people who are trying to fight ISIS.
Right.
And so let's give our listeners a sense and play this clip.
Thanks. And when I tell people about that part of your job, they almost always ask two questions. First,
there's a backpack right there, and I really want to search it, but I'm a little scared to put my hand inside it.
Isn't that dangerous?
They could be booby-trapped, huh?
Could be.
And I'm always like, yes, very dangerous. There are explosions.
That's close.
And gunfire.
Hey, smoke. You see this?
And airstrikes.
How many airstrikes have you heard before?
Three or four? Try like 10.
And the other question they ask is, how is that worth it?
Right.
Like, what do you say to that?
So look, every reporter that covers conflict and war knows that you have to be there. You have to be on the ground if you want to try to understand the story. And as for me, I'm trying to understand ISIS.
And that is from Rukmini Kalamachi's podcast, Caliphate. I understand the journalistic need behind
sure.
going in and getting that information
sure.
and the kind of information it provides to you
right.
and how much it enriches readers' and listeners' understanding of this particular group.
Right.
But I have to say, when I listened to your answer
right.
to your producer Andy's question,
right.
I felt like you didn't really answer the question of how is it worth your life?
Right.
How do you rationalize that?
Well, my goodness. I now feel like I'm talking to my mother because of course I have this discussion, you know, with her all the time.
I think that's the first time someone's asked.
Look, obviously when we go into these areas, it's not in a haphazard way, right? Every time I go into a battlefield situation, there's an entire security plan that has to be drafted. We have security advisors that we advise with. We go in a two-car convoy in case one of our cars breaks down. And then we proceed with great caution into these areas. That doesn't mean that the danger isn't there. Of course it is. But I'd like to think, and you know, perhaps I'm deluding myself, but I'd like to think that the work I'm doing is making a difference. I feel that I have been able to probe deeper into this secret organization than perhaps most reporters. And let's not forget that the war on terror is something that just our country has spent over $1 trillion, you know, to fight. We are spending blood and treasure to try to defeat this terrorist group, and yet it remains very little understood. So I think there is value in trying to do this.
So tell us, what are some of our biggest misconceptions about this group and
sure.
what you have learned?
Sure. There are so many. Our listeners might have heard of the conceit that ISIS made most of its money from oil. That oil and black market oil sales was somehow the way in which the caliphate was financing itself. And one of the things that I found in Western Mosul last year was a briefcase from an ISIS emir. It's actually the subject of next week's podcast episode. And this emir was basically an accountant for the group. And he was an accountant for the group's Ministry of Agriculture. And just in that briefcase, you have $19 million in transactions that this one accountant netted for the group from things like the sale of wheat, from things like bags of flour that are being transported around the caliphate. And what, in fact, we have learned is that this is a group that made money much like our own government does, by controlling land, by taxing the people who live there and the industries that are there and in Iraq that happens to be mostly agriculture. And therefore, this misconception that it was oil and that therefore we could bomb maybe the oil installations or the refineries and that this would make a difference, that was almost entirely wrong. Oil was a portion of their spreadsheet, but not even close to the majority.
Which points to another misconception that you say people frequently hold, which is that it really did function in a lot of ways like a state.
It did.
That it was organized, that it even provided some services better than previous governments.
Right.
So that said, could you just explain, just to back up slightly, what a caliphate is for our listeners who might not be familiar and how that all, you know, included their efforts to create a national functioning state?
So a caliphate is basically an Islamic state. It's a theocracy that is based on the religion of Islam. What they are doing is they are trying to mimic the style of governance that they believe was in place when the Prophet Muhammad was in the city of Medina back in the 7th century. Everything that they are trying to do recreates, they think, that time in history. So obviously, you have a 7th century value system, but that is being overlaid onto a territory that now has modern technology. So this is a group that is more adept than many of us on Twitter, on Facebook, on YouTube, and yet is dressing like people did over a millennia did ago.
And you have interviewed former members of ISIS as well as victims of ISIS violence. Starting with the victims, can you just – we know a lot about the brutality that in terms of the way that they carry out their killings.
Right.
And I want to warn our listeners that this conversation could get pretty graphic.
Sure.
So just putting that out there potentially in terms of the violence. But you have spoken with victims. Can you just remind us about just some of the measures that this group has gone to try to instill fear, to maintain this caliphate, and to try to impose these 7th century values, as you say?
I mean, as I think our listeners know, this is a group that practices savage brutality. violence on a scale that perhaps we have never seen, especially because they are also photographing and videotaping their violence. They justify this violence both by relying on religious texts and by improvising, quite frankly, by improvising. But the thing that is missed when we focus just on that is that this violence is strategy. It's strategy on a number of levels. In the first place, they are holding on, or were holding on, to a large piece of real estate. At its height, the caliphate stretched as far as the territory of Great Britain. Obviously, they came in there by force. Obviously, there's a lot of people that don't want them there. And this level of brutality, which was being advertised all over the caliphate, there were executions that were happening every day in traffic circles. They had put up big plasma TV screens so that people in the market could see on kind of a continuous reel some of the most horrific videos that have since come out. So part of the thing that they're doing is they're frightening people. They're frightening people into submission, into realizing this is what happens to you if you cross us. But the second thing that they claim that they are doing is they are trying to expand. And they believe that through this violence, they are going to cow us into submission. They are going to frighten the enemy into not attacking them. Now, obviously, that didn't work in the end. The coalition has thankfully been able to push back the caliphate. But I was traveling with Iraqi troops. And let's not forget, it was Iraqi troops that died by the hundreds, if not by the thousands, to take back this territory. And there were many moments when I realized that they were scared. They were scared because why wouldn't any human being be? You know that, God forbid, you're taken as a prisoner of this group. You're going to end up like the Jordanian pilot who was burned on camera. You're going to end up like this poor Syrian soldier who was literally driven over by a tank. You're going to be killed in a horrific way, and that does play on the psyche of the people that they're fighting. It's a useful tactic. It scares the enemy as well as the population they're trying to subjugate.
So how, on the other side of things, could a relatively normal human being, right, from the West or from Europe, join this group?
And that's the puzzle that I try to answer in Caliphate, because in the end, the Canadian recruit that we speak to, who wants to be known as Abu Huzaifa al-Kanadi, is not a monster. You know, I have sat with him in a hotel room. I have sat with him in a restaurant. If I can say so, he's kind of a goofy kid who gets lured to this group like so many others. After finding his way into these dark corners of the internet where this group recruits, and after ingesting what I would say is a steady drip of imagery that this group sends to its potential recruits, and the imagery is that they're images that are real of civilians being killed in Syria, people who died in barrel bombs, fathers crying over their children, and the pitch is, you're a Muslim. Muslims, the Muslim community is one body. When you stub your toe, your entire body recoils with pain. It is your duty, if one part of the body is suffering, it is your duty to respond. So what they're doing is they're actually weaponizing people's empathy. They're taking people, and I've seen this across the board. So many of these recruits from the West are lured in by images of Muslim suffering. And they then take that tug in the heart that we all feel when we've seen these horrific images from Syria, and they say, you can do something about it. Here's what you can do. Come join us. We are fighting the enemy. And of course, I mean, they're gullible because in the end, they're not really fighting the enemies of Islam. They're fighting a lot of civilians as well.
Well, we have a clip of a recruitment video, and we also have Abu Huzaifa, the Canadian,
yes,
who ends up joining ISIS for a brief period of time, responding to what he's hearing in the recruitment video in this clip.
Got it.
I specifically invite the youth to either fight in the West or join their brothers in the fronts of jihad.
What appealed to me was the sense of adventure that comes with it, and then the sense that you're going through survival and hardships for the sake of God.
You have two choices. You either leave or you fight.
You know, we're living a really comfortable life here, very comfortable life. And I didn't really get along with that.
You leave and live among Muslims, or you stay behind and fight.
And the voice in that clip, Rukmini Kalamaki, is Anwar Aulaki. Can you tell us, remind us who he was?
Aulaki is a seminal figure in the jihadist movement. He was actually a member of Al-Qaeda. The interesting thing is he grew up in America. Right. He's from New Mexico. He moved to Washington, and before 9/11, he actually apparently was a supporter of George Bush. After 9/11, he was one of the preachers, Muslim preachers, who was invited at these interfaith dialogues along with Jewish leaders and Christian leaders. And at a certain point, he began his, walk down into extremism, ends up traveling back to his birth country of Yemen, and becomes the biggest propagandist for Al-Qaeda. But what's interesting about Aulaki is he was famous before he was killed, but he is targeted in a drone strike by the Obama administration. According to my colleague Scott Shane, he's the first American, I think, to be killed without a trial by its own government, systematically hunted down. And after Aulaki is killed, his profile explodes. He is now quite literally haunting the internet. His lectures, like the one that you have heard, are the fodder of the recruitment of not just Al-Qaeda, but ISIS, Shabab, all of these groups that that prey on people in the West.
And Abu Huzaifa is drawn in by Aulaki's voice, and he describes to you going to Syria.
Yes.
He also describes to you, basically whipping people who did not follow the rules of the various territories that ISIS took over.
Right.
And he describes killing two people.
Yeah.
There's some question about the authenticity of those accounts. But even so, he talks about at one point, shooting a man in the back of the head. And then he talks about stabbing a man in the heart and placing him up on a cross. And what I want to play for you is actually his reaction to his own killings. This is from your, I believe your second or third podcast episode, or maybe it's the fourth one, where he really gets into some of this, because I want to give a sense of kind of the pull you can hear in his voice, that he's really kind of pulled between whether it was the right thing to do or not.
It just felt disgusting, but numb at the same time, like gloomy-ish. I just instantly thought, I'm a psycho killer now. Like, what the hell did I just do?
How frequently do you hear this kind of remorse or concern?
Almost never. Almost never. And when I walked into that hotel room, the fact that he had agreed to speak to me made me think that he must be somebody who was on the fringe of this group, perhaps an online sympathizer, right? Why else would he speak to a Western reporter? And my producer and I, Andy Mills, we headed to Canada, and we waited for him in a hotel room. He was hours late, so we actually thought he was going to cancel on us. And we could just, when he came and he began to tell us his story chronologically, and whenever I, interview these people, you always get to the question, have you killed anyone? But I'm used to, getting the stock answer. The stock answer for defectors from ISIS is, yes, I witnessed killings. I was in the presence of killings. I heard about killings, but no, I never took part in them, because they're smart enough to realize that could be used in a prosecution against him. And what was just so stunning is when I asked him that question, he started describing the killings, and he started describing them in just nitty gritty, horrific detail. As he started to describe them, I actually had this moment where I felt afraid for him. Our tape recorder was running. We had already agreed on the terms of this interview. And I knew that in that moment, he was incriminating himself. And so we listened to him. And what to me was stunning about what he said is, we're so used to hearing these accounts from the perspective of the victim. We imagine ourselves as the person like James Foley, who, oh my God, was kneeling at the feet of this executioner. How horrible that must be. we never imagine it from the perspective of the person who's wearing the black mask. And what comes across is that it wasn't easy for him to kill. And what also comes across is that ISIS understands this and has taken steps to basically condition people to kill on the understanding that in the end, this is the greatest human taboo, murder. And it's not easy to do.
Have you had people ask you or say to you, I can't believe you're humanizing these murderers?
Yes, yes.
What is your response?
I get that all the time. And number one, I think that humanizing is not the same as legitimizing, right? Of course, they're human beings. Of course. What else would they be, right? They are people in our communities who got up and for some reason joined this group. What has happened in our coverage of terrorism and our coverage of ISIS in general is because the acts that these people do are so absolutely ghastly, right? You look at these videos and they're so horrible that you immediately want to go, oh my God, that's evil. You know, oh my God, that person must be a monster, right? But when we go there, we miss the gray, right? It's not that their act is any less ghastly, but we miss the numerous steps that a human being goes through to end up being the person that is holding that knife and about to do that execution that Huzaifa just described. And my goal is to explain these people to the world. My goal is to try to understand who are they? Who are they really? And what do they really want? Because in the end, we are spending such an enormous amount of energy, time, blood, treasure in trying to contain this group. And we are failing. Over and over again, we are failing. Since 9/11, there are more terrorist groups now than there were before. There are more terrorists fighting us now than there were before. What are we doing wrong? So I think that there is value in this style of reporting.
And how would you answer that question in terms of what we're doing wrong?
Look, I don't have a specific answer to it. All I can say is that what my reporting has shown and the reporting of others, we are now in this sort of vicious cycle where when we intervene, we end up, whether we like it or not, causing human rights abuses, whether it's drone strikes that kill civilians, whether it's our soldiers torturing people in Guantanamo or in Abu Ghraib. And those abuses end up creating a cycle of recruitment that brings more people into the group.
We're talking with New York Times foreign correspondent Rukmini Kalamaki about her new podcast, Caliphate, where she digs deep, both literally and figuratively, to find out who are the people of ISIS. What are your questions for her? 866-733-6786 is the number to call. Again, 866-733-6786. You can tweet us at KQED Forum, post your comments on Facebook, on our website, kqed.org/forum, or email us at forum@kqed.org. I'm Mina Kim. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with Rukmini Kalamaki about how she uncovers the inner workings of the Islamic State. She's a New York Times foreign correspondent, and she has a 10-part documentary series called Caliphate, where she digs deep to find out who are the people of ISIS. And we'd like to invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. What do you want to know about ISIS, how they operate, what it's like to cover them? Our number, 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Our email address, forum@kqed.org. Our website, kqed.org/forum. And we're also on Facebook and Twitter. And let me go straight to calls. Let's start with Yahya in Oakland. Hi, Yahya.
Hi, how you doing? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
First of all, I'd like to get some clarification. And that is that when you use the term caliphate, you know, it does not, the term caliphate is not a political position. It represents the real true meaning of caliphate is the human potential. So when you talk about ISIS establishing a caliphate, you understand it in the sense that it's a political position, you know, and it doesn't mean that at all. it's the human potential in both male and female to be the best that they can be. Now, you know, I've written a book on Sharia law. You know, I hope that maybe I get a chance to maybe come on your program one day and we can talk about Sharia law. But ISIS, the Taliban, Boko Haram, none of these groups represent Islam. You know, when you talk about Sharia law, you're talking basically about the same thing as the Ten Commandments when you really understand it. And I explain all of that in the book.
Yeah, thank you so much. I feel like what he's saying is probably something you've heard where people are concerned that what we know gets, you know, basically conflated with Islam. What we know about ISIS.
And I think, I mean, obviously, we need to say straight up that a group like ISIS, Al-Qaeda, does not in any way reflect on the way normative Islam is practiced by the vast majority of the world's Muslims. That said, they are Muslim. And, I mean, you cannot join this group. If you are a Christian, the very first step in the recruitment is you have to utter the Shahada, which is the declaration of Muslim faith. You have to convert to their brand of Islam. I think an interesting parallel is the way we think of the Westboro Baptist Church in America. I think we understand that the Westboro Baptist Church, of course, does not in any way represent the way Christianity is practiced by the vast majority of Christians. But having met members of the Westboro Baptist Church, they are Christian. They pray to Christ, right?
Well, Yahya, thanks for the point. I want to go next to John in Fremont. Hi, John.
Hi there. So I had I'm just curious about how ISIS works in you know, in the areas that they are already holding. Mm-hmm. So, does the common people, do the common people in that area, they support ISIS? Like, do they, once they are in the rule of ISIS, do they find it better than what they were, what situation they were in before ISIS came in? What's the level of popular support that they have in the areas that they have held on to for some time?
Sure. John, thanks for that. And also reminds me, Rukmini. Yeah. Kalamaki, to ask you about how much territory did they have at their peak, and where are they right now in terms of their status?
So at their peak, they had a territory the size of Great Britain. The figure that the coalition has given me was around 110,000 square kilometers. They're now down to around 2,000 to 3,000 square kilometers. That's still, you know, that's still a piece of real estate. You know, it's not nothing. And it's at the Euphrates River basin at the Syria-Iraq border. What's worrying
about I'm sorry, how many people is that under their control?
At their height, it was over 10 million people. Now it's unclear. This is an area that is mostly in the deserts of Iraq and Syria. It's not a population hub like Mosul was. What's worrying is the U.S. administration is announcing that ISIS has been defeated. There's talk of pulling of pulling U.S. advisors out of Syria. The main rebel group that has been fighting this group, the YPG and the SDF in Syria, are complaining loudly that they're no longer getting the coalition support that they used to have. And it seems to me that we are making the same mistakes that we've made many times before, which is essentially leaving before it's completely mopped up. But to the questioner's point, how much support did they have? It's clear that they had at least some support. In the interviews I did in northern Iraq and especially in Mosul, you hear stories about how the day that Mosul fell, there were already cells that were inside the city that basically sprung up in and around the population. And residents, I remember telling me, the grocer who was living across from me, I had no idea that he was an ISIS supporter. But basically the next day he came out and he was wearing their garb and he had a gun. And so they have clearly some support. And then what they do is they are masters at playing on local grievances. For example, in northern Iraq, a common grievance was that the trash was not picked up on time. There was trash everywhere, and the street sweepers were not particularly effective. And ISIS took this really, really seriously. At one point, I had people telling me that street sweepers and garbage collectors were being paid as much as doctors. And they made a difference, and people said that the streets under ISIS were cleaner. Of course, the streets were also running with blood, so I'm not sure that that's, you know, such a great trade-off. But they were able to make these small adjustments and fix municipal problems that had been an annoyance for people. And that, I think, won them some goodwill.
Well, in an April statement, an IS spokesman called for violence against neighboring Arab nations. There's been a knife attack in Paris that was claimed by the Islamic State, a recent suicide bombing attack in Indonesia claimed by ISIS. What are the chances that the group will be resurrected anywhere near its former power?
So on the one hand, the territory was crucial to them in that it was through the territory that they made money. They taxed people and they taxed the businesses and commerce that were there. And this gave them a revenue stream that was in the hundreds of millions of dollars. So they no longer have that. It was with that revenue stream that they were able to do all sorts of things that were in a way creative. They were able to learn how to manufacture several of their own styles of weapons. They were making their own mortars, their own rockets. So they were no longer reliant on having to buy these, you know, on some sort of black market. They were able to buy commercially made drones and equip them to attack their enemies from the sky. So the fact that the territory is gone is a good thing. And means that it will be harder for them. But in the years that they held this territory, the biggest innovation that I think ISIS brought to terrorism is this ability to remotely control and remotely inspire attacks. The Paris attack that just happened, the stabbing attack that just occurred, appears to be in this category. The French officials have said that this man was radicalized. We don't yet know exactly who he was speaking to. But over and over again, we have seen that using nothing more than an internet cable or a Wi-Fi signal, they are able, from wherever they're sitting, whether it's in Iraq or Syria or somewhere else in the Middle East, they are able to reach out to disgruntled, troubled young men and get them to carry out violence in their name. And that is the thing that I don't think is going to stop, because for that, you don't need a territory. You just need access to the internet.
So it sounds interesting that maybe they may not be ever get back to their former state, but their tactics will have a lasting influence.
I think so.
Well, this listener wants to know, how does ISIS view the United States since the Trump presidency? What role does the Trump presidency play in terms of a strategy for ISIS?
You know, this is a terrorist group that views America as its cardinal enemy. Both the Obama administration and the Trump presidency, where I think the Trump presidency is in a way making it easier for the terror group, is one of the narratives they feed off of is this us versus them narrative. And they specifically, they have said in their own publications that they are trying to erase what they call the gray zone. The gray zone is are areas of the world where Muslims are able to live in cohabitation and harmony with other faiths. Namely in the United States, namely in Canada, namely in Europe. The rhetoric that we have seen out of the administration that demonizes Muslims, the ban on several majority Muslim countries, the immigration ban, including Iraq. It was Iraqis who were actually fighting, you know, this group. That is not helpful. And you see it reflected in the rhetoric on their channels. You see it in their private chats. And it basically just helps create this cleavage, where they are able to have more ground to stand on when they say, Muslims, you are not safe. Muslims, you have to come and join us. The only people that are standing up for your rights is this terror group.
Well, let's go to more calls. Julian in San Jose. Hi, Julian.
Hi. I have a question regarding recruitment tactics, I guess. From what I've read, there was a significant influence on something that was a significant influence on recruitment was rape and the ability to engage in rape and without consequences. I just want to read the last sentence of the Economist article that was about it, if that's okay.
Well, if it's short, sure.
It's gone. Never mind. I'm so
sorry. Oh, that's okay. But I think you ask an interesting question, Julian.
Yeah.
Mukmini Kalamaki.
Look, I don't. One of the horrible things that ISIS did is they created a theological justification for the abduction and enslavement and rape of women from the Yazidi minority. I have myself reported that they have used this, you know, as part of their general worldview. But I think it's a little bit too far to say that this has been a successful recruitment tactic, because in the end, these women and girls were being given to commanders of ISIS, to mid-level fighters, and to the fighters who had taken over that particular geographical area, Sinjar Mountain. So basically, people from the West very rarely had a Yazidi slave.
And are there women in ISIS who actually engage in anything other than being a partner to the ISIS fighters?
So at the very tail end of the Mosul battle, ISIS, like al-Qaeda, had long said that the role of women is in the home. They're supposed to be the mothers of the caliphate. They changed their guidelines towards the end of the Mosul battle, and Iraqi security forces told me that they began seeing I think there were at least 10 and possibly quite a bit more. They began seeing women wearing suicide vests who were coming out of the ruins, and because they're wearing, you know, the hijab and the long black robe, the vest was hidden, and as they approached Iraqi security force positions, they would blow themselves up. This was articulated in ISIS propaganda. They have now created a combatant role for women. And not too long ago, a couple weeks ago, they released the first video that showed women in the black abaya actually on the front lines shooting. So it seems that they have pivoted, perhaps out of desperation, perhaps out of the fact that they've lost so many men, and they have another class of people that they can use as fighters.
Well, this listener asks, how is she sure she's seeing who these fighters really are? Perhaps they're putting on a front for you, playing into a narrative. How do you know that the stories that you're getting from them are authentic?
Well, obviously, we can never take people at face value. So in the case of Abu Huzaifa al-Qanati, in chapter 6 of the podcast, which ran last week, we detailed the really rigorous fact-checking that we went through, which in fact encompassed many aspects of the New York Times. I called on my colleagues in Washington, who called on their security and intelligence sources, who came back and said that, yes, he's a former member of ISIS. Yes, he joined in Syria. We had his passport. We used the stamps in his passport to try to figure out when he went. We called officials in Turkey to try to see when he had crossed the border. We used the images he had given us, and my colleague Maliki Brown was able to geolocate one of the images to the Euphrates River. But we also detail where we learned that he actually lied to us. And he did lie to us. He lied to us about two specific things. When he went, he made it look like he went much earlier than he went, because he thought that it would look more innocent if he went in the early days of ISIS rather than after the James Foley video was released and everything else. And he lied about the travel document that he used. He told us that he went on his Canadian passport, but I had pictures of his Canadian passport, and we were able to see that those stamps that he was trying to tell me are the stamps into Turkey were not the stamps into Turkey. So that is my duty to listeners and to readers. We tell you what we know to be true. We also tell you what we know is not true. And then we identify the holes that remain, and holes remain.
Interesting. So he did not want to be associated with the James Foley beheading the journalist, who the major introduction of ISIS, I think, to the
West. To all of us, yeah.
Well, let's go next to Vanessa in Novato. Hi, Vanessa.
Hello. I've been following Mrs. Kalamaki's podcast since the beginning. It's been incredibly informative. And I have a question just about the status of what's going on with Abu Huzaifa. I know in the last podcast you mentioned and informed us about how he had maybe been contacted by the Canadian authorities.
Right.
And I was just wondering if you have any more information about if he is getting in trouble, if he's been taken into custody, or if they still don't actually have enough concrete evidence or proof of the deeds he told you about to subject him to any sort of criminal proceedings.
Thank you, Vanessa.
Thank you, Vanessa, and thank you so much for listening. So when we interviewed Huzaifa, we were able to get to him in November of 2016, and we got to him in this crucial window of time where he had returned from Syria, but he had not yet been visited by law enforcement. We were the very first people to speak to him outside of his family about this account. And I think that that helps explain a number of things. He thought he had slipped through. He got through the airport in Canada without any issues, so he thought he was in the clear. He believed that by not using his real name that he would not be identified. And so I think he spoke more freely than he later wished. The very next day, so not even 12 hours after he left us, we were supposed to meet him that second day. We were going to go to his house, see his place of work. And I woke up and he was blowing up my phone with text messages saying that CSIS, which is the Canadian law enforcement branch, had come and banged down his door. They had interrogated him. They had spoken to his family. He actually accused us. He thought that we had turned him over. Of course we hadn't. And that began what is now a year and a half long period of what appears to be both investigation and surveillance. He's had a car parked outside his house. He's had plainclothes police follow him around, and he has been brought in repeatedly for interrogations. What we have learned from our Canadian sources is that a confession is not enough in their legal system. They need forensic proof. It's very, very hard to get. It's close to impossible to get forensic proof of something that happened inside the former so-called caliphate, an area that was too dangerous for us to go to, and that is now gone, right? So I don't know exactly what is going to happen to him. I was speaking to him as recently as last night. I don't know that he knows. He's being brought in again and again for, you know, for talks with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. But what has happened in this year and a half is he has also changed his story because he is now afraid of being arrested. When he did an interview with Canadian television roughly a year after I spoke to him, he said the same thing that he had spoken to me, minus the killings. And that is kind of the version that he is presenting now, which is not unreasonable if you consider the fact that he's scared.
It sounds like you're convinced that the version he gave you is the truth.
I would not put my hand in the fire for this person. I don't know. But enough aspects of his story have checked out. And the one truism I know about this group is that they err on the side of violence, not on the side of peace.
You also said when he called you and said, did you turn me in?
Mm-hmm.
You said, of course we hadn't.
Yeah.
Can you explain to listeners
sure.
why journalists would not turn somebody
sure.
in or flag them to authorities
sure.
if they've admitted to you these kinds of horrific acts?
Sure. And I realize that sometimes to listeners, this is a confusing point. But as journalists, we are the fourth estate. We are not an arm of government, and it's really crucial that we don't behave as if we are an extension of law enforcement. If we did, then we become informants. Then we become an extension of the government, and we are attempting to be an independent entity that provides free and untainted information to the public. That said, I have to be honest and say that when we left that hotel room, we ourselves were struggling with what was the right thing to do. It in fact relieved us when we learned the next day that Canadian intelligence had come to his house. He actually sent me the business card of the person who had come to interview him. We called to make sure that the number was right. So he, you know, it was a Canadian. It said CSIS, Canadian Security and Intelligence Service, phone number, etc. So that allowed us to breathe. Because in the end, as journalists, if we begin turning in our sources, then that source is kind of the last one we will talk to. People will not trust us if we are known as being a news outlet that doesn't respect the confidentiality agreement that was entered into.
But it sounds like you struggled or at least had some
yeah.
feelings about the fact that he
sure.
was admitting these types of things to you. And so in some ways, by CSIS coming the next day, you didn't have to
exactly
worry about that as
exactly.
much. But that said,
yeah.
has there been a moment where you've said to yourself, this is too much? I mean,
yeah.
I imagine the reporting on this group takes a tremendous toll on you. You're dealing with these ethical questions. You are putting yourself in environments to try to retrieve documents
yeah.
where there are bombings going on. I mean,
yeah.
just very high intensity situations.
Right.
Have you had that moment?
A moment where it felt like it was too much?
Where you felt like maybe I need to just step back from this beat, from being so focused on getting the inside information about this group.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there have been a couple of moments. On this beat, the most painful reporting that I think I had to do was about the Yazidi women and girls who were being raped. I mean, to sit in a tent with these girls who are 12, 13 years old and who are detailing this horrific thing that happened to them. And I cannot do actually anything to really help them beyond trying to get their story out. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a therapist. Those were some really tough weeks, you know, for me. And I called on my friends. I mean, I called my husband, my dearest friends to sort of try to talk through it. But I come back to what I said to you, Mina, at the beginning, which is that I do believe that this work has an impact. So, for example, the story that I did on the Yazidi women, it was called The Theology of Rape, and it was published in 2015. That story, according to Yazidi community leaders who spoke to me, was responsible for prompting hearings in Congress. So it brought, it shone a light on this issue. It brought insight into this issue. And as a result of that publicity that came, countries like Germany stepped up and began taking in these women as refugees, giving them a medical program to help them out. So it felt like it felt like something happened, you know, as a result of that. You don't always get that satisfaction, actually quite rarely. But it did feel like it was, you know, like it was worth it.
We're talking with New York Times foreign correspondent Rukmini Kalamaki about how she covers the inner workings of the Islamic State. And you have noted on your podcast,
yes,
on Caliphate, that ISIS is aware of you.
Yes.
Can you share with us the extent to which you have felt targeted by them?
Right. So the FBI first came to see my editors and I in 2015. They had detected what they described as credible threats against me and against my husband. That was the one that really got to me, because in the end, I am out in the open. I have a Twitter account. I have a Facebook profile. But my husband is very much a private person, right? And I ran home with the glad tidings that, you know, the FBI has found our name in some sort of, you know, ISIS chat room. And they had given us the secondary information that it was apparently through Facebook that this woman had found him. Namely, she had friended me on Facebook without me knowing who she was. And then from there, she had found our pictures and identified who my husband was. And that's how his name had appeared. And my poor husband spent the evening trying to figure out how to tighten his Facebook security settings so that my friends could not see his profile, and couldn't figure out how to do it. And at the end of the evening, he basically unfriended me on Facebook. He was like, so my husband is no longer linked to me at all on Facebook. And I know I'm making light of this, but at the time it wasn't funny at all. You know, this was, it was obviously like upsetting, you know, that this had happened. They came to see my editors and I two more times, 2016, 2017. And the thing is, you know, they come and they say this to you. It's a little spooky, but then you just kind of go on with your life. But what it does is it kind of raises your awareness so that when weird things happen, your first thought is, oh my God, is this related to what they told me, or is this just some jackass who is drunk and is, you know, and is in my way and is being unruly at the bus stop?
Well, Bill has a question. He says, besides drones and bombs, are any anti-ISIS groups attempting to counteract ISIS propaganda with preaching, mm-hmm. dropping leaflets, using mm-hmm. social and traditional media, etc.?
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting point. So there are a number of sort of informal do-gooders who are online. Among them is a guy called Mubin Sheikh. He's a former extremist himself. And I actually introduced Huzaifa to him because, in addition to the notion that Huzaifa had, you know, had confessed to murder, I was worried that he might try to hurt himself. And Mubin has sort of made a little, you know, life for himself where he trolls the internet looking for these guys. And when he finds them, he starts his own sort of like informal preaching, you know, to them. And he's not the only one. Jesse Morton is a former recruiter for Al-Qaeda. He was released from jail not too long ago. And he's doing the same thing, you know, online, where they're basically using the street cred that they get from saying, you know what, I was in your shoes. I believe these things. I know that verse you're citing. I know it very well. I use it myself to recruit other people. Let me tell you, it's not a good place where you're going.
Well, let me see if I can squeeze Tony's question in. Tony, thanks for waiting.
I have an ISIS question, but first I have a very quick comment about the role of a journalist who's also a citizen. When I was an AP editor in Miami a long time ago, I got a phone call in the middle of the night from a guy who said, Biscayne Bay is going to blow up. And a little while later, a bomb went off in Biscayne Bay that was set by one of the anti-Castro groups. My ISIS question is two-part, just quickly. What do you think, is ISIS civilized, and what is your definition of civilized?
Tony, thanks. 30 seconds with me.
All right. Wow, that's a tough one. I mean, obviously, they're not civilized in the way that they kill people. You know, this is savage, this is cruel, this is horrible. But what gets missed when we look only at that is the sophistication of their state-making apparatus. Because, for example, in Mosul, they were able to pick up the trash in a more effective way than the government they usurped.
So would you describe them as civilized? Would that be a word you'd attach to them?
No. I mean, that's a tough one, Rina.
Rukmini Kalamaki. The 10-part audio documentary series is Caliphate.
Thank you so much
for coming in.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Have a great weekend.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.